The jesting Pharisees seek to trap Jesus, and within his answer, this little phrase, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Jesus, our brother, kind and good. You remember that line? Remember that little old song? Can anybody sing it? Jesus, our brother, kind and good, was humbly born in a stable root. Okay, that's enough. You remember. Some of us at least grew up with that song, right? Even though it's not in the hymnal, it's an old Christmas time song for children. If you were in a children's choir, you sang the friendly beasts, believe me. I am sure the purpose of the little song was to make us feel comfortable with Jesus when we were little. It was to give us a sense that there was a kind of familiarity, an unthreatening connection with this person, Jesus of Nazareth, our brother, kind and good. What could possibly go wrong? Many of you probably have brothers or sisters. And you might have an idea of an answer to that question, what could possibly go wrong? I don't happen to have any. But I spent this past weekend in the company of many of my cousins celebrating a family birthday, and I observed them interacting as brothers and sisters, a thing that I, as an only child, have always watched with the kind of fascination that naturalists use to study other species. And what I noticed about these brothers and sisters all regathered together, eight of them in all, is that there are certain unspoken rules about sibling relationships. They are close, but they are close in a certain way and not in other certain ways. Somehow they know almost instinctively where the boundaries are and when they are coming up too close to the fences that divide them. Here is the specific thing I noticed. Watching my cousins interact with each other, I've noticed that there are important and not necessarily explicit rules in these relationships about the giving of advice. Getting advice from your co-workers or your friends, your neighbors, or from members of your church, that's one thing. Getting advice from your brother seems a very different other thing. So there's a little problem here. If we learn at an early age to cast Jesus in the role of brother, we are probably not likely to be very willing to accept his advice when it comes. And it comes today in very direct and unambiguous terms. The Jesus we see in the Gospel from Matthew this morning is nothing like a brother. He is by no means meek and mild. He is not even very kind. It is a Jesus responding to a challenge, really a pretty childish challenge, typically of Matthew's gospel. It is the Pharisees cast in the role of the children, the obstreperous, belligerent, testing, unwilling children. They want to catch Jesus in a trap. They are playing at puzzles. They ask him a question they imagine to be unanswerable. Which commandment of all the commandments we've received from Moses, which is the greatest? There are 10 of them, right? But that's not all. There are 603 other rules, obligations, and laws in the Hebrew Scriptures. So tell us, Jesus, which one of these is the greatest? We heard the answer that Jesus gives in this morning's gospel. It seems very unsurprising to us because we've been hearing it all our lives. Indeed, those of us of a certain age in this room used to hear it every Sunday. Peter's nodding his head sagely. At the very beginning of the communion service, in a little line called the Summary of the Law. Because these words are so familiar to us, we really can't grasp the drama in the exchange between Jesus and the Pharisees, or the way that Jesus shifts the ground of the whole debate with his answer. The answer he gives is to restate the very first commandment of the Torah, love God, and then to summarize the other 612 rules into this single phrase, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is claiming the authority to restate the entire covenant law. This is not offered in the way of advice. It is not the calibrated counsel of a brother. This is a directive. It is spoken in the tones of a parent, not a sibling. There is no room for bargaining. There is no negotiating. There is no wiggle room. Instead of catching Jesus in a trap, they have discovered something even more real about his authority. Jesus is laying down the law here. The church often wants to give us a sense of comfort with Jesus. That is how we start out as children. Jesus, our brother, kind and good. But we cannot leave folks there, and we cannot leave ourselves there. We are concerned, maybe even afraid, of turning people off by talking about the Jesus who is clear, who is unyielding, who is not really interested in hearing our protests. We're afraid of people not even giving us a chance if they hear something they don't like. And in some churches, that concern has become a kind of doctrine unto itself, a gospel of the inoffensive Savior. But of course, that is a faulty compromise. If we make it into something we completely agree with, there is a good chance it is not the gospel. We need that voice of clarity, even especially when it jars us. We need the uncompromising directive, even when it feels as though it diminishes us. Now, I think you know, if you hang out here much, that I generally refrain from telling stories from this pulpit. Most of you have figured that out. The message of the week for me always seems more important than any vignette from my own life. But here is one through which I understand what Jesus is saying this morning. Many years ago, I think I was in the third grade, and a new kid showed up in our class at the beginning of the year. His family had just moved into town because his father had taken a new job. It turned out that his father traveled from time to time on business, a thing that I could not really imagine because my father worked in gas stations. So we were already pretty different. It turned out that one day, right about this time of year, right in the midst of this kid's first few weeks with us, he showed up in class one day wearing a really cool necklace. Now, mind you, this would have been about 1969, so the words cool and necklace could be uttered in the same sentence. It wasn't so much the necklace that was cool, but the pendant on it. It was a cast metal hand with two fingers raised in a peace sign and an image of the White House in the middle. His father had been to Washington. As horrific as that sounds, that's what I think it was. Into class, this kid came one day wearing this enviably cool thing. And of course, immediately, he became a target. I'm not sure whether it was morning or afternoon recess, but what I do remember is that I asked to look at it, and I took it in my hand, and for reasons I still do not understand, I grasped it too tightly. And of course, it was just made of cheap pot metal, and one of the fingers snapped right off. My new classmate, rightly proud of this gift from his father, shed tears of genuine anguish. We were, after all, just 10 years old. I felt more disappointed in myself, more truly shocked at how careless I could be than I ever had in my whole life. It was an all-around awful moment, and when I went home, I still felt awful about it. Now, I cannot imagine that that young man's parents called my parents to complain. They were not that sort of people. And anyway, in the Midwest in those days, that was not how parents raised kids. I'm pretty sure instead that what happened was that my mom saw that I was awfully upset when she came home, and before long she had the story out of me. And I'm equally sure that pretty much the same thing happened in that other boy's house. I can't know for certain, but what I do know is that my mother did not worry greatly about offending me in what she said to me. She told me to march right over to that other boy's house. He lived just around the corner. To apologize and to offer to buy him a new necklace to replace the one that I had ruined. And I don't know, but I'm pretty certain that pretty much the same thing happened in his house, in the inverse. I'm pretty sure that he was sternly instructed to be forgiving and to accept whatever meager apology I managed to offer, if indeed I offered it. There may even have been some parental collusion above our heads. I don't know. But of this, I am certain. I did make that walk to his door. It was maybe 200 yards. It felt like 20 miles. I did ring the doorbell. I did apologize. And I did offer to replace the necklace. And I did know the incredible relief of having my apology accepted. I was never able to find an exact duplicate of the fingers of the White House thing. But I found something that I thought conveyed the same idea. I think it was a peace sign or something. And to my surprise, I was actually excited to find it and really excited to give it. Now, friends, this story is not about the moral failings of 10-year-olds. It is about the quality of the moral guidance that we need and the kind we think we prefer. We want to decide for ourselves what kind of recommendations to accept and which ones feel a little too encroaching. We want to retain final authority over our own actions. That feels more in keeping with what we think is our dignity. But left to my own designs, I would probably never have figured out by myself how to do a thing I dreaded doing. Without a strong parental directive given without the slightest room for negotiation, I wouldn't have done the right thing. I would like to think more highly of myself, but the fact is I didn't do it until I was told to. We do not like being instructed in that way. We think we are not children anymore. But when it comes to our spiritual lives, we still stand in need of direction, even though sometimes it may come to us without cushion or comfort. Love your neighbor as yourself. Apologize when you hurt someone. Forgive those who have wronged you. When those directives come, they never seem to offer any clear benefit to justify the discomfort and the difficulty. But here is one last thing I know. 45 years later, maybe almost to the day of that long ago October afternoon on the playground, I sat down and had dinner last week with that same boy. We remain friends today, and I do not doubt that it has a great deal indeed to owe to our parents' clear guidance then. We are now both older than our parents were then. But, at least speaking for myself, we are maybe not significantly less in need of directives from time to time. And I am sure I would not today know the gift of that friendship had it not been for some pretty clear moral instruction from a source uninterested in dialogue. Jesus, our brother, kind and good, there is a time and a season for that sweet notion. But we are headed toward the end of the church year, and we will be getting there through a series of lessons that reminds us in no uncertain terms that the man from Nazareth is also our teacher, our guide, our judge, and our king. When the advice sounds too harsh, that is likely a sign that there is greater profit in taking it seriously. The grace that we find to take the advice yields gifts we cannot imagine nor ever deserve. Amen.